Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. It's always a privilege and an honor to have you here tonight. We'll try to get through this, well, every week we try to get through it on time, but we'll try to get through it in a timely manner tonight so we can go home and enjoy the festivities of our democracy. It's not going to be the end of democracy, it may be the end of bureaucracy, but maybe not the end of democracy. I saw a great little video of that, how everybody was talking about the end of democracy, and with artificial intelligence, they came over and overrode the word democracy with bureaucracy. You just had a bunch of people freaking out. It's like, we're going to lose bureaucracy. This is the end of the bureaucracy we're used to. The bureaucracy is going to end. It's like, yes, tonight bureaucracy and bureaucracy ends. It's like not democracy, but bureaucracy. Okay. We'll see. It'll be really nice if we're back in class next week, continuing on with our Bible study and not hunkered down somewhere or whatever. We'll see. But God is on the throne no matter what, if up or down, whatever happens. This is, you've read the end of the book, and it doesn't always end with sunshine and rainbows.
Bureaucracy or bureaucracy?
What's that?
Is that bureaucracy or bureaucracy? Bureaucracy or
Barack? Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it could be, I'm not going to say it live, I got to cut it out, but it could be his bureaucracy, yeah. Well said. Okay, just don't make, I hope that didn't come on the video. All right. I did run a risk with my profile picture on Facebook. I didn't know, I put a little red hat on and put, you know, pasted it on. So yeah, anyway, here we go. Genesis chapter 12, verse 6. We've got a map, a very important map on the front page there. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. You've got Ur up here, if that's where Ur's at. Again, I'm putting it there for this time through. Many times I've taught that it's down in southern Mesopotamia. But if Ur is up here, then he goes, they're going to spend 5 years in Haran. And gains, we'll read right here, he's going to gain more possessions. Now God has promised him, we saw the blessings, that God is going to be with him, he's going to prosper him, he's going to be blessed both spiritually and physically, and he's going to give him a seed and make him a great nation, and that nation is going to bless the world. And that's the promise that is going to be given to him. And it's already starting here. He gains more here, and after 5 years, he leaves to go to the land of Canaan, which is, again, Galilee, Dead Sea, Jordan River connecting them. And we're going to go through three basic places. You can see it's going to be Shechem, and then it's going to go between Ai and Bethel, where an altar is going to be built. And then he's going to move into the southern area called the Negev. And we'll talk about that. Here's Bethel here. Here's Ai. That's not exactly correct. And then Negev is down here. And tonight he's going into Egypt because there's going to be a famine, which is typical there in the Negev. And so I will read what you see right there on page 1. I've got in the English Standard Version verses 12:5 through 12:9. And then at the bottom of the page we start again with 12:4 with the Hebrew box or the text, and then a little bit of explanation. But this will kind of give you a feel for what's taking place here tonight. And Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran. I do want to point that out. I'll probably say it again tonight. They acquire people in Haran. While they're here, Abram is not just, again, the Sunday school image, and again, I mock the Sunday school image, but I'm not mocking your Sunday school image. I'm mocking the Sunday school image in my mind that, you know, I grew up Abraham and Sarah, you know, wandering around with a camel, you know. And then when you start reading the text, it's like, wait a minute, this is much more than an old man and an old woman wandering around in Israel. They're gaining people. These would be servants, so they're gaining almost like a tribe, a community of people that's moving. The only one that's related to him appears to be Lot. And again, you got to consider Lot. His father has died. That would be Abram's brother has died. And so in Abram's mind, he may have adopted Lot. Now, that's never mentioned in the text of Scripture, but when he's thinking about having an inheritance, I would assume if I was Abram
and I had a nephew that was living with me, I would be acquiring wealth, assuming that it's going to go to my nephew, which will then be adopted as my son for the estate. The Bible doesn't make that explicit, but that's just kind of common sense. And God's going to interrupt that several times. You can see, well, we'll talk about it. Here we go. But anyway, Lot's going with him, and it may be an intentional move by Abram. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land of to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh, and we'll talk about this. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And I'll do this very quickly as we go by this. The Canaanites were in the land, and we have, there's very little remaining of the Canaanites. Now, there's culture at that time, archaeological work. There's no writings of the Canaanites. The best we've got is Phoenician. There's not a lot of, you know, Canaanite history. Here is apparently a Canaanite altar. Now, see, it's been excavated down. This is at Megiddo. And this is, excuse me, the altar. It's a big round altar. There's some steps right here. I'll show you another picture. This is the wall of the temple that was setting in front of the altar. See that stone base there and the stone base there, and there's one over here. Those would have held wooden posts, wooden timbers that held up the temple that was sitting in front of this altar, and it's got a series of steps going up here to this altar. This would be a Canaanite altar. It was used between 3000 and 1000 BC. Now, here is the same Canaanite altar. I just, you know, you can see there, that's the altar. The temple's out here. That's no longer there. But you see the remains of the steps, 1, 2, 3. I think there's 7 steps going up to that altar. This is all excavation work down here. So Abram, when he went by Megiddo, and you can see on your map, you can see Megiddo is marked there after Damascus, Dan. We looked at a picture last night of Dan, the gateway of the city of Dan that was the where the king sat. That would be at Dan. That was more of an Israelite gate than it was Canaanite gate. Then through Hazor and then Megiddo. So he's passing by Megiddo. over there you can see that's Jericho. That's the wall of Jericho, or the foundation of the wall of Jericho. The clay blocks would have been built up on top of that. When the wall collapsed, that retaining wall, you know, was holding the dirt up. The wall of the city was on top of that. So that would be something that would be Canaanite also. But nonetheless, the point is, this land is not empty. There's already a civilization living there, the Canaanites. And so that's pointed out. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land, and then their descendants from Ham. Then the Lord appeared to Abram, there at Shechem, and said to him, To your offspring I will give this land. Interesting, your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And we know exactly where that is at. We know where Shechem is at. We know where Bethel and Ai are at. We know this location. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Now, one of the questions I'm going to present is he offering sacrifice? When you say altar, you think sacrifice. There's no mention of Abram offering sacrifice, like burning sacrifices, except with Isaac on Mount Moriah. So these altars, the things that he's building here, they could be for sacrifice. They could be claims of land. They could be, you know, stakes, like, you know, not stakes in the ground, but they'd be like what we'd say a stake, a monument, an altar that this is now my land, a claim of land. Okay, and there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord, and Abram journeyed on, still going towards the Negev. Now, here it's the Negev, the Hebrew word, the bet. It can be pronounced the vet or bet, you know, either a B or a V, depending on the Dagesh. Of course, Tyler understands this. But so some translations Negev, some translations Negev. That's the same thing. It's not a mistake. There I just write, 3 specific places are mentioned in the land of Canaan, and only 3. Shechem, where he builds an altar, sanctifying the land to the Lord, apparently. between Bethel and Ai, he builds an altar and calls on the name of the Lord, and then the Negev. Later on in Genesis 23, you know, rushing ahead, when Sarah dies, he's going to buy a field in Hebron, which is in the Negev. He's going to actually purchase land, a cave that he's going to use to bury his wife, and that's where he will be buried. And eventually that's where, you know, Isaac, Rebecca are married, and then Jacob is brought back and buried there. It becomes the family tomb. It's still in Hebron today. Okay, now chapter 12, verse 4, that's the bottom verse right there on page 1. After the Lord speaks to him, I'm repeating myself now. So Abram went as the Lord had told him from Ur, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So he goes from Haran, he's 75, and Sarah is going to be 65, which is going to be an interesting concept as we get down later into the story. Page 2, chapter 12, verse 5, we're going to read it again. And Abram and Sarah, his wife, took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired. Once again, they were acquiring people and wealth, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, chapter 12, verse 6, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. So he's going to go down to the Shechem. Again, if we were to take this as if this is going to be helpful, here's the Mediterranean Sea, Galilee, Jordan River. Here's the Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem. This is Shechem right up here. Just a little ways over here is going to be Bethel and Ai. Now remember, when they attacked, when Joshua comes across and destroys Jericho, the next battle they go fight is this little city called, little place called Ai. They don't think they need to take many people, but Achan had stolen the golden bar and the Babylonian garment, and so God's curse is on Israel when they go attack Ai, and Ai drives the Israelites back, and they're totally confused, and Joshua has to realize what's happening. So again, you can realize Jericho is right here, just like you can just see the Jordan River, it's right there, and Ai is just a little ways away from Jericho. Abram's going to stop right here and build an altar. Bethel's on this side. This is Jerusalem, which is not mentioned in tonight's account. It's probably called Salem at this time. It's occupied by some kind of Canaanites. Melchizedek is going to be introduced there. He's the king. That's another story that's coming up. And then this land here is called the Negev. It's a wilderness land. And you've got places here like Beersheba, just Beersheba, Beersheba, and Hebron are in this area. They're not mentioned tonight. But here at Shechem, you can see it says, I got two things in a box. Moreh, it's a place near Shechem. Moreh is a place near Shechem, and there's a tree called the terebinth tree, as you translate it. It's some kind of an oak tree, some kind of a tree that's at Moreh. The oak of Moreh that's here beside Shechem. Now, trees were often something that would be planted by a holy site, or they were a place of, you know, communication with the gods or of worship or sacrifice, a holy site. So it appears that Abram goes to a place that's already recognized as a holy place right here. And there he goes and builds an altar. This is all the information we've got. So you see, he goes through land to a place at Shechem. The city is Shechem. There's a place there at Shechem. It's the oak of Moreh. It's an oak tree at Moreh, which appears to be a holy site outside or beside Shechem. The Canaanites are in the land. They're probably using it. And here comes this guy, Abram. Now again, my Sunday school image, here comes Abram and Sarai with their camel, and they stop and build an altar here in Bethel, and hardly anybody notices. But you go back, he leaves Haran and had acquired more people and more wealth. He's got Lot, who's building his own household and has inherited everything from his father because he was the only son, and they arrive at Shechem. And Abram just moves on in to the place, the Oak of Moreh, which is identifiable. And there he builds an altar. And everyone's kind of like, I mean, now it doesn't say this, But it's not just an old man and an old woman. It's a whole community has moved in, and he builds an altar at a holy place. It's like, what's he doing? Looks like he's participating. He's putting his God or his name in the community here. And that's, you can see right there at Sechem, at that time the Canaanites were in the land, and maybe that's why it says it right there. At that time the Canaanites are like, What is this? This guy just invaded our land and just going to pass through. Now, if you turn, okay, here's some more notes here. Sechem is 35 miles north. This is Jerusalem. So to give you perspective, this is 35 miles up to Sechem. I've got a picture of Sechem. I was there a couple of times. Bethel, if you remember, is where Jeroboam, the one who was Solomon's building foreman and helped build the temple. When Solomon died, his son Rehoboam became king, but he was a poor king and Solomon had made some mistakes. And so Jeroboam gets 10 of the tribes and he sets up, he has the northern tribes of Israel. He sets up a golden calf at Bethel. So this is the southern border of what's going to be the northern kingdom of Israel with 10 tribes. This will become the kingdom of Judah, which includes the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And then eventually all the tribes are going to flee down here during the Assyrian. And they're going to be members of all the tribes. And he set one up in the northern part of his kingdom at a place called, and you already know it, Dan. And I've showed you pictures probably of the golden calf temple that is still visible, and the steps, very fine stonework, you can still see it, where the golden calf stood at Dan in the northern part of the northern kingdom, and the southern one was Bethel. That's not part of our story tonight, but you understand the location. He's at Sechem right now, and that's 35 miles north of Jerusalem, so Bethel is even closer. Sechem, this city we just talked about, is mentioned by, and again, this is kind of fun to see this for my own self. In Egyptian texts, they refer to Sechem from 1880 to 1840 in the writings of Pharaoh Sesostris. The Canaanites refer to a multi-ethnic group of people, meaning it's not just one group. It includes the Amorites, the Hittites, the Moabites. Not Moabites, but there's a wide, the Phoenicians. There's a wide group of people that would be considered Canaanites. By 1200 BC, any mention of Canaanites has disappeared. Now again, I'm getting that from research, reading books. That's not my own opinion. Israel's moved into the land and the Canaanites have kind of either melted away, and any historical reference, the Bible may recall them or refer to them, but historically the Canaanites they've just been moved in with and been adopted into Israel, or they faded away. And there's no remaining writings of the Canaanites or anything of substance. Turn to page 3, and there you can see at Sechem, and I've got it on that marked on that picture. It says Sechem there. That's the city of Sechem, and on the south side or the left is a rising mountain or a mound, a big hill called Mount Gerizim, and rising on the right side is Mount Ebal, and that's there today. And you know that from Joshua entering the land. That's where Israel comes back to this place. In fact, I've got right there a verse. I'll read it to you in a moment. Moses telling the people, "You're going to go to this place. You're going to go when you get into the land. You're going to go to Sechem." He tells them that. And there, when Joshua leads the people in, some of the people are going to go up on Mount Gerizim. You can read about this in Joshua, and some up on Ebal, and they're going to read the curses and the blessings of the law to each other. I think Mount Gerizim, they're going to read the curses. Mount Ebal, they're going to read the blessings. They're going to shout them back and forth. This is the land we're at, and they're right there. Guess what's in the middle of it right there? There is, just like we saw here in this image, you've got an altar, and you can see the other one. You can see where the temple's out in front. Here you've got a stone, a standing stone. It's still there. I took this picture in 2012. And that's an ancient standing stone that was probably there in Old Testament. It was there in Joshua's day. It was definitely there in the days of the judges. And there's a little, like a round retaining wall around that standing stone. It's possible there were walls up on top of that retaining wall, just like That's the wall of Jericho right there. You're looking at the wall of Jericho, and you say, "But wait, I thought the wall of Jericho fell down." Well, okay, let me correct it. That's the retaining wall, and up on top of that, there was mud bricks standing up on top of the retaining wall. In fact, you can see here in this picture, you can see mud houses. See right here, this wall right here? Those are mud bricks. You can still see the square mud brick. You can still see straw in the mud right here. They were attached. The walls went up and made contact on the outside of this wall, and they, of course, would have been higher on top of this retaining wall. You know, just think about landscape work. You just got a retaining wall. It's your foundation, and the wall was built up here. So when it says Rahab lived in the wall, these are, they've been excavated, these are residences that were on the outside of the wall but built up onto the wall. So these would be potentially, and if not this one, it would be in this area where Rahab would have lived higher up here. And same thing, this was higher up. When they excavated this wall of Jericho, these walls were not knocked in. These walls had fallen out, which is not normally when you can excavate a destroyed city. There's been a collapse then. They've been, you know, battering rams, but they just collapsed out. But anyway, this, I'm showing you that so that when you look at this picture here on page 3, it's called Baal Berith. In the book of Judges, it's called Baal Berith. In fact, one of the judges goes there and is trying to find fortress there, and as he's attacking it, that's where a woman pushes a millstone off the top of the wall and crushes it, kills him. And David recounts that story. That's in the book of Judges. It all takes place right here. So, Shechem. Sychar is that how you spell it? Sychar? Is that how you spell it? In the New Testament, the woman at the well, Shechem, Sychar, the Samaritan woman, that was in this same, that's going to be a new name of the city right here. So this is where Abram comes to in Shechem. When it says the oak of Morah, it's possible this is a holy site. Well, it is a holy site. It's a temple. It's a fortress. It's got a standing stone. It's Ebal and Mount Gerizim. It's where Joshua came after Moses told him to come here. This is where he came. So this most likely had a tree, a holy tree, a sacred tree, the tree of Morah by Shechem. This is the area that Abram comes to and would have passed through this valley between Mount Gerizim and Ebal. So that's all taking place there in chapter 12, verse 6. Now, just so you can see, I've got written down there underneath that picture, Deuteronomy 11, verses 29 through 32. So this is on the other side of the Jordan. When Moses was over here, and I don't want to just ramble on and keep telling details, but when Moses was camped out, there's a good chance he was camped out at Sodom, right here. Sodom was a big city that had been ripped, laid waste. It was a flat spot, and this is the high place where Moses probably set up camp, and they ended up leaving here and going across the Jordan. And that we can, Dr. Graves and those guys talk about that. This would be, because, you know, Sodom had been just wiped out and buried, but this place was a high place to look over the disc right here that led into the land. Anyway, from this point over here, Moses in Deuteronomy says this to the people right here. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, you shall set the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Okay, so I got them turned around. Blessing on Mount Gerizim. Oh, yeah, no, I said it right. I said it backwards. Mount Gerizim is the blessing. Mount Ebal is the curse. Are they not beyond the Jordan? Now, remember, Moses had never been there. Unless as an Egyptian he invaded the land or something, but that's probably not the case. Are they not beyond the Jordan, west of the road towards the going down of the sun in the land of the Canaanites who live in the Arabah opposite Gilgal beside the Oak of Morah? So now in 14, this is 2000, we'll just say 2100 BC possibly. This is now, Moses is speaking in 1406 B.C., so you've got 700, 600 years later, that oak of Morah is still being talked about by Moses. For you are to cross over the Jordan to go to take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you. And when you possess it and live in it, you shall be careful to do all the statutes and the rules that I am setting before you today. And so that's taking place in 1406 B.C. And they're going to come and set up the same place at Shechem. It's just interesting. The first place that Abram goes is Shechem, after he enters the land. And the first place Israel's to go after they defeat Jericho, get past Ai, is they go to Shechem, to the same place, the tree of Morah. Probably you've got a photo of it right there as it's been built up. And once again, that's probably the retaining wall. That's not the wall of the temple. That's probably the retaining wall. And on top of that was all the pillars and the bricks and the mud clay structures. Okay, chapter 12, verse 7. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So at that very place, at Shechem, at the mount, the oak of Morah, right there at Shechem, God tells him, to your offspring I will give this land. And that's probably where he then builds an altar as a confirmation. Right here on that picture, he probably builds some kind of an altar there, probably beside other altars or holy place of the Canaanites, that's basically is a testimony, this is my land. And he doesn't stay, he just moves on. But then 600-700 years later, Joshua shows right up here again at the same place. It's like, this is where Abram set up the altar when God said, this is your land. He says, okay, I claim it, it's his. And now notice how long it took. It took 600-700 years for his descendants to get back there to claim the land. Now you do know what's going on. God is going to talk to Abram as this story goes. He's going to say, your descendants will go to Egypt. They'll be in there for four generations because the sin of the Amorites or the sin of the Canaanites is not yet full. He says, it's going to take four generations and they're going to be down there in the land. He says, they'll be there for 400 years while those four generations reach the place of the curse of the fourth generation, and then he wipes them off, and that's where they come in and they're going to reset the land, and you can just see God controlling history. He's making the promise to Abraham, but there's no war, there's no threats. It's just Abraham passing through with faith, putting up altars, saying, but this is where it's all going to happen. And then he moves on through the land. Nothing happens. I mean, Abram just gets wealthy. He just receives the promise. And the Canaanites are in the land at that time. So what do you do? I just moved on. He just received the promise. Very interesting. There's a lot to that story. And it's faith. And again, you don't want to read too much into it, except it's just a story. I mean, it's a historical story. But it's like, that's the point. He's just moving through the land, hearing the voice of God, putting up altars, saying, okay, does he understand it? I mean, he understands this as much as I understand the millennial kingdom. I mean, it's like, I know something about a kingdom on earth, 1,000 years, it means something. Jesus is going to be here, will be resurrected. Now, someone that's living there will be a lot more specific. Abraham, he's not real sure. His descendants may come through Lot, as far as he's thinking. I mean, I added that to the story. Okay, built an altar, point one. There is no mention of sacrifice. The only sacrifice mentioned in the Bible concerning Abram is Isaac. This altar may be a territorial marker of the land or a land claim ceremony such as is used by Joshua in Joshua 22, 26 through 28. Therefore, we said, let us now build an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you and between our generations and our generations after us. So in other words, you see an altar being built by Joshua in Joshua 22. It says in the text, this altar that he builds is not for sacrifice, not for a burnt offering. And he even says it himself. It's as a testimony for those that are coming after us that this is our land. And so I think we're free to read back into the story that he sets up an altar there at the tree of Morah, right here at this location at Shechem. There's no mention of a sacrifice ever, except Isaac, and that ended up being a ram. There's no offerings or sacrifices, but there's altars. And here's an example of an altar being set up for one purpose, and that is to say, this is a promise God gave me, and it's a testimony to the generations coming. Don't give this up. This is our land. Okay, that's page 3. Turn to page 4. Chapter 12, verse 8. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. So now you can see right there, I've got a dot there where Sechem is at with Gerizim and Ebal, the mountains there. And then you move down through Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle is going to be set up. And then down there between Bethel and Ai. And he doesn't go to Bethel. He doesn't go to Ai. He goes to the hill country that they're in. And between those, he sets up an altar. And there he calls on the name of the Lord. You know, prays to the Lord, calls on the name of the Lord. You know, seeks guidance, seeks direction. And that's the end of that. It's like there's nothing said there except he's walking through the land. And you can see that he's going to go down. Now, while we've got that map, follow the gray line. There it says Negev, and that's the territory down here. That's the wilderness. That's the desert. And on there, I want you to see two underlined cities, Hebron and Beersheba. And look at that. See, I did that wrong. This is Hebron over here, and this is Beersheba on this side. You can see on there a better location. Now, Tony, in that picture right there that you can see, she is in the Negev. We've driven through there a couple of times. And the Negev is just like that. You see, it's just a wilderness. It's barren. It's dry. There's camels there. I can tell you stories. And you can see in the background, if that's a better picture, you could see, but there's a road in the background. And it's just like, it's like dry. Okay, the song by America. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. I could go on. That's not where they were when they were, but that is what they're singing about. And how all of a sudden it rained and a river flowed. You know, there once was a river, now it's gone. Because when it rains, the rivers, the riverbeds, the nahars fill up with water and they're just like a river. And then all of a sudden all the water's drained away. And it's just a dry riverbed. And it can happen. There's been tourists walking around in the Negev, and it rains up north here. This is dry, but there's riverbeds running into the Dead Sea or running into the Mediterranean Sea. And it rains up here, and the water rushes down through the river system, and you're out here just having a little, you know, foreigner in the Negev walking through the, having fun, taking pictures. All of a sudden it's like, oh, it looks like the Red Sea coming right at you, coming here, and just washes them away, and you never see them again. And so that's the Negev. So that's where Abraham goes into the Negev. So turn the page. Chapter 12, verse 10. And after that introduction, this next verse makes complete sense. It's like, wow, that's strange. Now there was a famine in the land. Well, duh, you're in the Negev. It's like, no, wait, there's no food here. Right, there's nothing here. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So he gets down here, and you know, you can see the picture, and it's like, you better be prepared. When you get here, you better have a plan. And you're coming from, well, you're coming from Ur of the Chaldeans. You stayed in Haran for 5 years. You passed through Dan, Megiddo, Sechem. Oh, this is a great place. This is a hill country. There's green trees here. Well, there's a green tree of oak of Morah. Nice place. Nice. This is a nice place to be. Then you come down and it's like, whoa, where did we go? All of a sudden, you're in the Negev. Now, Abraham is going to eventually, in Beersheba, is going to dig a well. And it's going to be a big deal. That well is still there today, because when you dig a well, you penetrate down to the ground, you come back 10 years later, it's still there, 100 years later, it's still there, 1,000 years later, that hole is still there, tapping into the water resource. So that well of Beersheba is still there. And the name with Beersheba, it refers to the wells, 7 wells. Okay, so there's a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe. And you can see on the next map on page 5, I've got Bethel and Ai. I've got a little arrow drawn into the Negev. And now he's going to travel about 220 miles to the Nile River, or Heliopolis, or Heliopolis, or on Memphis. That's about 220 miles down into Egypt. And he's just, this is where, you try to make some great moral story out of this. You know, a man of faith should have stayed there. Well, yeah, maybe he should have stayed there and fought it out, or maybe he should have turned around and went back up to Shechem. But remember, who's in the land of Shechem and Ai and Bethel? The Canaanites. It's like, down here in the Negev, there's some room down here. There's still room down there. Nobody, I mean, we were there. People own it. There's grazing cattle in places. There's camels. Someone's going to claim the territory, but there's not like cities. There's some, but it's an open land. So it was probably felt a little safer down here. But when he gets there, he realizes why nobody's there, plus the famine comes. So now he leaves the land. And again, I'm not going to stop and make some kind of message about Abraham should have had more faith. And then, especially in verse 11, this is just, Abraham's just living real time, real life. And take your lessons if you want to. He could have stayed there and trusted God, or he could have used his mind and went down to Egypt where he's going to sojourn for a while. Jacob does the same thing. That's how Jacob and his sons get into Egypt, because of a famine. They go, and Joseph saves them nonetheless. So this is not the first time someone in our stories are going to go down to Egypt because of the famine in the land. Okay, now he's going to be entering a land of Egypt. Now he's heard stories. Here's the border. It's called the River of Egypt, right? There's not the Nile River. It's just a boundary there. Here's down here. I'm way off the map. You're going to go into Egypt. He's got a concern. And he knows people. He knows people in Ur. He knows people in Haran. He moved through Shechem. And again, this is just a strange story. But it's not strange. It's just, if you understand it, it's not strange. It's just, I don't fully understand it. Here it is. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife. Now, he's going to say something all men say to their wives. But we're going to assume it's true. That's true for me when I say it. When he is about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance. Now, he doesn't say anything about her character or her soul or her faith. He says appearance, because that's what's going to be. He doesn't say anything negative about her soul or her faith or her character. But this is what's going to be noticed when we go into the land. They're going to see you are beautiful in appearance. Now, remember, she's 65, which, again, this used to be comical when I was 20, 25, 35. A 65-year-old woman. It's like, beautiful. You know how she looked like someone's grandma. And then, of course, I see Tony, who's going to be 65 next June, and I think, well, it is possible. But you know, 65 is totally, I'm just being personal here. 65 is totally different now than it was when I was 35. It's like, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, when you're 25, 30, you can't, a woman who's 65, it's like, there's no beauty there. Well, in this story, it is. Now, she's 65. It says her beauty would depend on cultural standards. Again, so when we think a beautiful woman, there's something pops into our mind that culture has influenced. Okay, a beautiful woman in the 50s and the 70s and the 2000s and the day, that can be a different hairstyle. It's different. So nonetheless, in this culture, Sarah was beautiful. And what we know is, one, the eyes were a big deal. The eyes were beautiful. You know, like Leah, her eyes, they called her cow eyes because her eyes were apparently ugly. She might have been fine looking other ways, but her eyes were cow eyes. Now, what that means, we'll have to study that when we get there. But Her form and eyes would be part of the standard of her being beautiful. And beautiful woman in these cultures, they're with the kings with their harems. Part of the operation would be to, you know, take beautiful women to the king or abduct them. And that is what it appears Abram says. When he was about to enter Egypt, verse 11, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance. And when the Egyptians, the common citizens or the officials, see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. They will eliminate me to get access to you, a beautiful woman. So, here's how we're going to solve this problem. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. Well, now you understand that sounds like a plan, but if you really think through it, you realize we're talking about Abram being a leader of a group of people, gaining in wealth, being called of God, a man of faith. But he comes up with this plan because she's his wife. He will be eliminated so they can have her. But if you say you are my sister, they will let me live. Now, what? And then what happens? It's like you think, oh, she's a beautiful sister. We'll let her live with her brother. It's like in the end of the story, she's still going to get taken. Either he dies and she gets taken, or he doesn't die and she gets taken. No way this story ends with, well, that's her husband, so we'll let her live with her husband, any more than that's her brother, so we'll let her live with her brother. I mean, again, I'm reading way too much into the story because it just doesn't go that much detail, but he tells her this. Now, say you are my sister, so that may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. In other words, I may get some advantage, just like I had in Ur and Haran, and probably until I started building altars here, claiming land for myself, I had to get out of there. Now, more details of Abraham and Sarah's relationship are revealed in the account of Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. This is coming up later in Genesis 20. So this is not the first time, this is not the only time this is going to happen. And then Isaac is going to pull a similar stunt. So this is how guys with beautiful women moved around without getting killed. In Genesis 20, this is not our story tonight, Abraham said, after Abimelech found out that Sarah wasn't his sister, Abraham says, I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, he says, she is indeed my sister. So Sarah and Abram were brother and sister, they did not have the same mother. Sarah had a mother. Abram had a mother, but they both had the same father. Terah fathered Sarah with a mother. He fathered Abram with another mother, which would make them what? Is that half sister, half brother? She is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother. And so we have an account of that happening here in Egypt, and we have a case of that happening here with the Philistines later on. But the way that's worded, every place they went, no one knew they were married. If you read that just literally, that happened every time. They were always just a brother and sister traveling together with a large inheritance. Okay, so there it is. When Abram entered Egypt, here it is, chapter 12, verse 14, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Fill in the blanks, how'd they know, what'd they judge, what was their standard? And when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, so that's just the people. I mean, Abram comes riding in on a camel with his wife on a camel or something, and everyone's like, whoa, look at her. Okay? That's just the people. Well, when the princes of Pharaoh, this would be his officials or possibly his sons, saw her, they praise her to Pharaoh. You should see who came to town today. And the word spreads to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, it doesn't tell us how it happened. If 10 officials raided the house and kept Abram sitting outside of his house for 5 hours while they went through all of his stuff and found his wife and his donkeys and his squirrel, we don't know about that. But they took her. We don't know how. We don't know all the details. And again, that is where we would like to know some details. How'd they take her? But I can tell you what, it appears Abram's like, sure. It's like, well, and he's probably going to get some kind of, in fact, he will. If this is going to be a wedding dowry, if it's going to be payment for his sister, if it's going to be some kind of compensation for damages that could have been done, he is going to get and probably has a plan here of getting money from this or gaining. Well, it says right here. And she was taken into Pharaoh's household. So now, this is wrong on so many levels, but specifically on the level of God telling Abraham, through you, I'm going to bless the nations. You're going to become a great nation. And here's the wife. And again, we're going to see later on, he's not too worried about Sarah being the mother of many nations because he's going to use Hagar to fulfill the promise. So what is Abraham thinking? How much does he know? Anyway, she's in Pharaoh's house. And chapter 12, verse 16, and for her sake, he, Pharaoh, dealt well with Abraham. He's getting treated like part of the family. And he had sheep, seven things, sheep. Now, again, Abram didn't come in here with nothing. He came in with a whole group of people. He came in with possessions, cattle. But now, Pharaoh had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female servants, more people, female donkeys, and camels. Seven things were given to Abram because of Sarah. Now, if it's just showing him favor because, hey, you're part of the family, or if it's a dowry, here, brother, I'm buying your sister from you. But Abraham now makes more money. If he had 200 servants, he's now got 300 servants. Again, I made that number up. The gifts were not explicitly described as a bridal gift, but the gifts do appear to be some kind of compensation. Chapter 12, verse 17. But the Lord, because this is not his plan, afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now we begin to find out the promise is not just Abram, but this is Abram's wife. She's going to become the father of this nation, and she can't be in Pharaoh's harem. So he shuts the harem down. And how he shuts it down is everyone gets some kind of a plague. And that word plague or disease is the same word used of the plagues in Exodus. It's used to refer to skin diseases in Leviticus 13 in the Mosaic Law. It's used to refer to the leprosy that struck King Uzziah in 2 Kings. So, when it says plagues, it is most likely something breaks out on their skin. Pharaoh and the harem, everyone's got this something they're passing around, and you could go down to, you know, STDs or something's happening there, and it's like it shuts down the activity of Pharaoh there, and so Sarah is preserved because it's the whole practice of the harem is like interrupted and it goes on hold for a period of time. Again, I'm reading the same thing you're reading, adding details to it which maybe are inappropriate. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. And I'm building that all off that word, great plagues, great skin diseases. So Pharaoh called Abram. Somehow Pharaoh's got insight. He called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Once again, details are missing. how does he connect this disease in the harem or in his household to Sarah? And how does he find out that Sarah is actually not Abram's, well, she is his sister, but is his wife? Again, you can assume he did some investigation. If you drop down into chapter 12, verse 18, I'll read that and I'll read some more. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife?" And then point one, this account does not reveal how Pharaoh found out. I've got two examples right here. It happens again with Abram with the Philistines, and it happens again with Isaac and Rebekah. And here's those two accounts. In Abimelech's case, now it doesn't tell us how Pharaoh found out. But in Abimelech's case, God came to Abimelech in Genesis 20, verse 3, in a dream. He tells the king of the Philistines in a dream and said to him, God speaks to the Philistine king Abimelech and says in a dream, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." So when Abram lets Sarah, I don't know about marriage today and everybody's situation, but I cannot see this going well with Tony the first time, let alone trying it a second time. If we're married, we've all made mistakes, and then in most cases we learn, I'm not going to do that again. I mean, if it's, I'm trying to think of something, the towels in the bathroom are, Tony's towel is special. You don't just grab her towel and dry your hands on it. You don't just grab her towel and wipe up some water on the sink. Her towel is used by Tony. She washes it when she wants. I'm not making fun of Tony. I'm just giving you a specific illustration, probably not even necessary. But I've learned, because at some point I've used her bath towel to like just quickly maybe dry my hands or wipe some up, and it's like, my towel's wet. Oh, yeah. And it's like, she wasn't ugly, she wasn't mean, but it was like, you'll never do that again. And it's like, I know. It's like, I will go around her towel. I will walk around the towel because I'm not going to make that mistake again. Yet Abraham sends his wife into Pharaoh's harem. He gets chewed out by Pharaoh. And when he comes to the Philistines, he says, I've got a great idea. She's my sister. And does it again. I won't even wipe up water on the sink with Tony's bath towel a second time, let alone send her into the Philistine harem after I sent her into the Egyptian harem. It's like, I mean, these are just things. What is going on here? As far as relationships. Nonetheless, Abimelech was told in a dream that his whole household had plagues, and God says, you're as good as dead because you've got Abraham's wife. Isaac's a little more entertaining. In Genesis 26, verse 8 and 9, in Isaac and Rebekah's case with the king of Gerar, the king of the Philistines, they're local kings in cities. It says, when he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of the window and saw Isaac, and I've got the word underlined, laughing with Rebekah, his wife. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, she is your wife. How then could you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, because I thought lest I die because of her. Now Isaac does not have the excuse. Rebekah is the daughter of another man and another woman. They're not even half anything. They're just of the same tribal relationship. That's why they went up and married. But she's not his sister. But that word laughing, I've got it in just for entertainment pleasure here. I put it there in the Hebrew text down there. It's in a box. It's mashahek is the word. It's translated in the word for word as sporting. So if you put that in there, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out of the window and saw Isaac sporting with Rebekah, his wife. Sporting. I think it's kind of chasing each other around in the yard, or, you know, playing some kind of tag there in the courtyard or under the window. He looks down and, you know, they're giggling and he's tickling her or something. The word means to laugh. It also can be referred to as laughing with caressing, entertain, jesting, and playing. He was playing, caressing, being entertained. They're entertaining each other, and he saw them sporting with each other and says, "That's not how you treat your sister. That's your wife." And that's just a little more entertaining. But that's how Isaac blew the cover, was he was actually, well, I would say, flirting, making a move on Rebecca, and they got in trouble. Okay, we don't know what happened this time, how they found out, but God is already ahead of the game, shutting down the harem. Pharaoh comes out and says, "What is this you've done?" Chapter 12, verse 19, page 7. "Why did you say, 'She is my sister,' so that I took her for my wife?" Now, again, Pharaoh, in this case, in their culture, is not doing anything wrong. He's the Pharaoh. He's got women. He's got a harem. And he's collecting beautiful women. Now, again, I can argue that case. That's not how God designed it in the Garden of Eden. It's not right. But that's, he did not think anything wrong. And especially, I paid for her. I gave you all these cattle, all these servants. It's a fair deal. I just took her as my wife. But Abram now, culturally, both morally and culturally, is totally in the wrong, which is going to set up a nice ending for this story tonight. "Why did you say, 'She is my sister,' so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And if we read the next verse right there, chapter 13, verse 1. I'm on page 8. "So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot went with him into the Negev." Now, chapter 13, verse 12, "Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold." So Pharaoh doesn't take back all those seven items that he gave him, including men and women, servants, male and female, donkeys, camels. He doesn't take that stuff back. Abraham gains all that and gets his wife back. And the point there would be, this cannot go down. This cannot go down as, again, be careful. You got to interpret this and understand it, what God intends. We just have a story, a historical document. But this is not Abram being blessed because of his faith or because of his obedience. At least not his obedience or his culturally treating people fair. I mean, he's lying, he's running, he's trying to get out of situations. But all that comes because of a promise. So Abraham, he is a man of faith. He does believe the promise, so he's got faith, but he doesn't know necessarily always how to act in this faith. He believes this promise, but the strength right here, is, I'm going to say, is not necessarily in Abraham's faith and obedience to what was commanded. That's going to come later. We're going to see Abram's going to be obedient. This is all a result of what God had promised Abram. He's going to make him great. He's going to make his name great. He comes out of Ur with possessions, comes out of Haran with more possessions. He goes to Egypt and gets more servants and more stuff, and now he comes back into the Negev. He's prospered here. He prospered here. He prospered going through the land. He prospers in Egypt. He comes back because God is continuing to do what he said he was going to do with Abraham. The point is not that Abraham's getting blessed no matter what he does. The point is what God promised to do in Abraham's life is going to happen if Abraham cooperates or not. He doesn't say, "I'm going to make you into a great nation, but you've got all these things you've got to do. I'm going to make you into a great nation, and you're going to be a blessing." Now, Abraham is not going to be able to earn or deserve all these promises. Israel does not earn or deserve all that God has promised them. It is a promise. It's standing on, if anything, this story is saying, all of this is based on God's word, God's plan, God's promise. Look at Abram, all the things that Abraham does, and he doesn't even understand it. God is going to get it done. Now, Abraham is going to grow and mature. Abraham believes the promise, but how do you earn this kind of, how are you going to earn this? How are you going to be worthy of this kind of, I mean, it goes right back to our salvation. I mean, if you want to make an application, You all are children of God. You are all sons of God. You are all heirs of Jesus Christ and his inheritance. And thank God you're all living up to it. It's like, well, just like Abraham, we're running from things we don't know what to do with. We're compromising on things we don't know. I don't know, but it's like the promise is not based on our earning it now that he's hung it out. Now, Abraham's going to grow and mature. We're growing and maturing, but that promise is, again, the thing that's driving this whole thing is God's promise. Now, on page 7, I do want to point this out. I've got a picture of the guy right here. Intef the II. He was the Pharaoh of Thebes. If we go down here, and you look at that map that I've got there. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Nile River right here. Way down here. This is where Abraham, this is what we'd say southern Egypt. This is called Lower Egypt. This is called Upper Egypt, where the mountains are, the water comes. Thebes, T-H-E-B-E-S, was the city a couple hundred miles down or north in Upper Egypt, and the water flowed down into Lower Egypt, into the Mediterranean. It looks reversed. This is lower, this is upper. Thebes is here, and that is where Intef II ruled from 2108 to 2959. So you look at Abraham's life, that is the time period right here. Abraham dies in 1991 BC, so 2000 BC. He leaves Haran in 2091, so basically 21 to 2000, that is the time period that he would have been in. He would have been in Egypt with Intef, and this is the Pharaoh. If that is, he was from Thebes, but he conquered and took control of this land. He's buried in Thebes. You know where he's buried. You can see inscriptions. There's pictures of him. This could be, this is the Pharaoh who was ruling Egypt when Abram was there. If it's the exact same king it's referring to in this northern part or lower Egypt, that could be debated. I think it's the same guy because by this time he was ruling, coming out of Thebes in the upper Egypt, he was ruling all of Egypt, the lower, middle, and upper Egypt. And there's some details about him. He ruled for about 50 years, reigned in Thebes, and his tomb's there. You can see his tomb today. All right, we'll pick this up. Abraham has gone back into the land with even more possessions with Sarah. And again, they're not traveling alone. They're traveling with many possessions, many people. In fact, the next thing that's going to happen is Lot even gaining possessions. And they're going to come back into the land and realize there's not room for us both in this land. I mean, not only do they have to deal with the land that the Canaanites already live in, they've got so many people that we've got to separate because the promise is happening. Even though Abram isn't earning, deserving, or working for it, he's just trying to follow God and let God bless him. Just like us, we've been saved, and we're just trying to follow God. It's like we're on our way to the kingdom of God. It's like, what do? Well, just start learning and try to keep up because God is doing something great in your life. And the quicker you learn, the more obedient you're going to be and make it, cooperate with it instead of always doing dumb stuff. I don't know. And that's just kind of an evaluation. Who knows if it was dumb or not? I would suggest sending your wife to Pharaoh. Not the best idea. We'll find out. Okay, I'll pray and we're ready to go. I appreciate you guys coming out. Father, we do thank you for the Word of God. We thank you for the Spirit of God. We thank you for the opportunity to be alive at this time. We thank you for the great promises you've given to us, and we humbly accept those promises, knowing that even the moments that we think we're doing great things for you, that we're still probably stumbling and going the wrong direction. And we do ask that you continue to show your patience and your grace to us, that we would appreciate it and allow you to work your plan in our lives to achieve the things that you've got planned to do in this earth during our lifetimes through us, that we would not get in the way but allow it to be manifest and be able to participate with your greatness in our own times. In Jesus' name, we do thank you for this opportunity, and we pray for our nation tonight and ask for peace. We ask for prosperity, and we ask for revival to righteousness. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. Were you listening, Tony? Oh, hey. Election. How's Kamala doing?
Not as good as Trump.
Oh, shoot.
He got Florida.
He got Florida?
Mm-hmm. And Florida's amendments lost. So that abortion one, it was like up to birth or something?
Oh, yeah.